whatever I talk about tonight, these are my thoughts, my understanding of Buddhist practice. It's a very narrow slice of what we could possibly be talking about. We could take any one of the eightfold factors and talk about them just for the whole talk very easily. But what I'd like to do is to talk for a shortish period, and then we can have a conversation, if possible, about some of the things that are relevant for you, rather than me talking about what I think is relevant to you. So the Noble Eightfold Path, what is right and what is wrong? So we know that the Noble Eightfold Path is pretty much central to all Buddhist traditions. We find it everywhere. It's an encoded way of understanding Buddhist practice. And it is a path to be walked, should we choose to do so. It can be walked in a whole lot of different sorts of ways. And each of us will come to it in a slightly different way as well, I think. So in understanding the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths, it's quite useful to put it into its context. That is, why it came about. Why did the Buddha think this was important? That gives us a way of beginning to understand some of the central ideas to be found in the Eightfold Path. So we want to try and think, what was the Buddha's motivation? So we can then ask, is it anything similar to my motivation? Maybe it's completely different. Maybe I need to view this completely differently in my own way. Now, I'll get into this later, but we know that we have this word samma, which is usually translated as right. So right mindfulness, right concentration, and so forth, the eight factors. Samma is a potentially difficult word or a complex word. It provokes a whole lot of reactions. But one of the interesting things about samma is, if it's right speech, right action, right livelihood, and so forth, it absolutely implies its opposite, wrong. And so if something is right, something must be wrong. And so if we go back to the beginning of the story with the life of Siddhartha and why he left the householder's life, maybe we can get some clues about what he thought was going wrong, and that will give us some ideas about what he means by right as well. So let me read you something from the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses, that the Buddha is reputed to have said. He's talking to the monks and he says, "Before my enlightenment, being myself subject to birth, aging, sickness and death, to sorrow, etc., I sought what was subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, and so forth." So he was seeking those things which were subject to all of these things like sorrow, old age and so forth. Was chasing after them, or maybe enmeshed in them. And then he had a thought, and there's various pictures that are painted as to why he had this thought, but nevertheless, he had a thought, why, being subject to birth and so forth, should I seek what is subject to birth? Suppose that being myself subject to birth, having understood the danger of what is subject to birth, I seek the supreme security from bondage, nibbana, liberation. And so forth and so on. So the question he's asking himself is these days what we would call an existential question, a question about existence and what is worthwhile, how should I live? It's a question we often come to in times of crisis. It's something people often experience when they're about 16, 17, 18, and then we tend to get caught up with things like university studies. And then maybe a little later in life when we're more established, or maybe we have something happen that makes us not so happy, we can ask those same questions. What's the point? So these are existential questions, and the Buddha phrases them in this particular way. That is it useful, is it helpful to chase after these things that themselves are subject to impermanence and change and so forth? Should I be caught up with them? Should I just keep chasing after them? And clearly he sees that as not very helpful, as being a way of cultivating pain, actually cultivating suffering, and really not worthy of pursuing. So he's suggesting that many of the things maybe that we chase after, that we want, that we hope for, we may need to think about and think clearly about whether they're going to give us exactly what it is we think they're going to. We hope they will. So he's asking us really, in other words, to turn towards this idea of change, the idea that things age, the idea that we can't hang on to things, that eventually they pass away, All things pass away. We can't stop anything from passing away. Try and stop a thought. Look at my gray hair. Try and stop that. It's not going to happen. But in doing that, it is potentially quite challenging for us because it can make us feel or respond in certain sorts of ways. He's asking us to turn towards what is uncomfortable, and that seems very contradictory and wrong-headed, doesn't it? Why would we turn towards something that's uncomfortable? There's plenty of discomfort around already. So in even being invited to turn towards the uncomfortable, we tend to have, broadly speaking, two responses. One is to go, oh, well, why would I waste my time with that? I'll just keep doing what I'm doing. And we tend to get involved in activity. We do that even at very minute levels. So imagine you're sitting on your couch at home, maybe as you are now, or your desk, and you sit quietly for a few minutes and you start getting bored. What do? We go on and we get a great game up that we can play, an interactive game. We start texting our friends or responding to Twitter, watching Netflix. So we tend to move away from discomfort into distracting activities. It's such a basic human response. You know, when we're asleep, we turn over. We know that nobody stays in the same position for the whole night, although sometimes we think we have. What turns us over is just this basic level of discomfort. We move away from it. If it's too uncomfortable, if we've been sleeping on one arm and it goes to sleep, that might wake us up. But on the whole, if we're good sleepers, it's just discomfort that moves us most of the time. You know, we often say, I'm going to do something enjoyable. What that implies, as with the word some or right and wrong, that something, if we're going towards something enjoyable, it means that what we're experiencing now is not that enjoyable. So once again, we're moving away from discomfort. If we've got comfortable lives, usually very low levels of discomfort. So we can try and avoid or move into activity. However, the other response sometimes is when we start trying to consider these questions of turning towards what causes us to suffer, we can get a bit caught up with that. We can move into almost a despair, a slight depression. We just feel down. You know, again, what's the point? And we can feel a bit stuck with it as well. So we do need to be a little bit cautious about turning our attention to these things. And we'll come back to that because there are some strategies around that. But, you know, even if we broaden our scope, go a bit more macro and move beyond ourselves and start looking around the world, we don't need to look very far to see injustice, cruelty, selfishness, and to feel that these things are just ongoing and maybe even getting worse. So that can overwhelm us as well. And the natural inclination is either to get very angry or to simply try and push it to one side and avoid it. They can be quite extreme reactions. So we can feel that we can't do anything, it's futile, or we can become angry and maybe become involved in causes and so forth as well. So in the face of all of this, the Buddha has this rather radical and counterintuitive idea, and that is to turn towards that suffering, to try and observe it. But he does give us some clues about how to do that as well. And the whole proposition, as you all know, underneath Buddhism is that if we turn carefully and, you know, mindfully, cautiously towards discomfort of mind, of the emotions, social discomfort, that we can learn something about the deeper causes of suffering or discomfort. And that is a sort of a pathway, an arrow, a sign that can help us live in ways where we reduce that discomfort. So we're being asked to do something quite challenging initially, and that is to turn towards what's difficult, what's challenging sometimes. Now, this is not to deny pleasure, is not to deny happiness. In fact, the Buddha himself says, why should I be afraid of what makes me joyful? So this is not a path of asceticism where we need to get a big stick and beat ourselves up. Do you remember the story of the two ascetics who approached the Buddha? And one was doing the cow practices and one was doing the dog practices. And the cow practices and dog practices are basically to live your life as though you are those animals, eating in the same way, sleeping in the same way, acting in the same way. And they rocked up to the Buddha apparently and said, so, you know, how are we doing? Good rebirth? And the Buddha said to the cow duty ascetic, no, you'd be born as a cow, reborn as a cow. And he burst into tears. And of course, he had to ask the question. The dog duty ascetic said, so, you know, wolf, what about me? And the Buddha said the same thing. Well, you're going to be reborn as a dog. So there's a teaching there about karma and so forth. But the point of that is extreme asceticism, which the Buddha himself tried in very extreme ways, is not a path that he embraced. So he's not into causing ourselves extra pain. You know, there's plenty to go around already. We have enough to work with. Why would we cause ourselves more pain? But there may be some initial discomfort in taking up this practice or even thinking about it in order to gain this more liberated view and way of being. And fundamentally, the Buddha is saying that what causes us deep suffering is when we identify with those things. We don't see what's going on. So we know this is called a wisdom practice. And it's the practice of seeing into, and hence the word insight, seeing into what causes suffering. And it's a path, so we can't do it all at once. But it's a path that is meant to free the heart and mind from suffering, not lead towards more suffering. Okay, so that's a little background on the Buddha and perhaps what we can discern of the Buddha's motivation and where he took that, why he left home and renounced the household life. I want to make a point, though, that that all these teachings are integrated with each other. That is, if we could subtract one teaching from the Eightfold Path and say, well, this is the main one and we don't need to worry about the rest. But this path is not just linear. It is a path that feeds back into itself like a feedback loop. If you imagine that infinity sign, you know, the wiser we get, that contributes to greater wisdom and more clarity around our action and so forth. So this is an integrated path. We need the full depth and breadth of the teaching. If we pull out one factor, it becomes a bit free-floating. It loses that context that I've just been talking about that came out of the Buddha's own experience. And once we do that, we could use an aspect of the path for almost any use towards any end. So the famous monk Ajahn Sumedho says that many years ago said that we could use mindfulness to become a better sniper. And certainly there is training happening for, you know, various military forces around the world in mindfulness. Now, it's mostly around resilience and trauma recovery, but nevertheless, there is an ethical question in there as well that we haven't got time to debate tonight. That would be a whole conversation in itself, wouldn't it? Now, remember that right mindfulness or any of these factors of the path feed into what the Buddha said about this radical critique of self-enhancement, self-addiction, really. This is a path that leads away from self-addiction through seeing the nature of the self, what leads to liberation, what leads to suffering. So we could even use this practice to build up a sort of almost a selfishness around ourselves. And even Buddhist meditators can do that. You know, look at me, I'm at the fourth jhana. Oh, yes, I remember that. That happened to me a couple of years ago. I'm on sixth jhana now, that type of thing. You know, we can even use the path. But if we integrate the practice into all of these factors, and if we understand what's underneath it, the fundamentals of the path, at least we know when we're doing that, and we try and work actively to not get caught up in that selfishness, not using the Eightfold Path just for our own personal gain again. And one last point about taking factors, individual factors out of the path. We all know that mindfulness is a huge buzzword. We, you know, get online for 2 seconds and there it is, it's everywhere. There's quite a few different interpretations. It's used for lots of different things. But it's interesting to me that what was one aspect of the path has now become almost like the catch-all. It's the big heading. And what's happening more recently over the last 5-8 years is people are discovering or reinventing aspects of the path that were already integrated. Things like loving kindness and compassion. So compassion has been rediscovered, as it were, reinvented. Loving kindness has been reinvented. And there's just some interesting papers coming out about selflessness, and there's some ideas about therapies that talk about selflessness. So these things already existed, but they weren't standalone items. So what's happening is that we're seeing one item pulled out and interpreted in somewhat narrow way, not necessarily a bad thing, but it makes it non-Buddhist. But these other factors we would consider to be part of Buddhism, traditional Buddhism, are being reinvented or rediscovered. So it's an interesting process that's happening. Okay, so that's some background there as well. So an integrated path. So you can almost start anywhere here. And the path you all know is, you know, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And often divided into three, as you know, which is wisdom, virtue or ethics, and concentration or meditation. A very simple way of remembering those main aspects of this Eightfold Path. So we come back to the word samma, you know, samma ditti, right view, for example, samma sati, right mindfulness, S-A-M-M-A, samma, this is in Pali. So, and the language the early texts were eventually written down in. So samma is often interpreted or translated as right. And I'm not a scholar, and I only pass this on to you through my own reading and practice. I don't think the word right is wrong in this respect. And it does imply wrong, of course, and that's very useful for us because there's undoubtedly a foolish or ignorant what path to take. And maybe we like those words better than wrong. But it can also mean something like correct or good, complete, or even perfect. A word I have seen used, which I don't think is entirely accurate, but it feels good, is the word wise. So wise view, wise intention. It's a very nice word. And if we understand what's meant in a Buddhist context, there's probably nothing wrong with using that word either. It has some resonances about what we mean by wisdom in Buddhism. So this is the word samma, and it does provoke some reactions. And certainly amongst, when I've taught mindfulness, for example, or Buddhist practice to Westerners, but people who aren't particularly Buddhist, there's a real pushback adjudged, or that we're excluding people, you know, oh, if I'm right, you're wrong, or that other views are wrong. We need to remember that the word right here or samma refers to a Buddhist perspective. Now, other people are quite free to have their views. And even in the early suttas, we see that some people came to see the Buddha, had a chat, went, oh, yeah, that's interesting and thanks very much and I'll be on my way. And the Buddha didn't seem fussed by that. He wasn't trying to, you know, make everybody believe that his view of right was the universal right. In fact, really, he was quite encouraging of people over the whole of his teaching career. Once they had the fundamentals, they had to work it out for themselves. And in fact, reputedly, his last saying was, you're an island unto yourself, be an island unto yourself. You need to work this out for yourself. That is, you need to apply it to your own lived life. Understand the fundamentals, do the practice, whatever that means for you, and learn from your own experience, your own meditative experience, your own social interactions, and your reading and conversation and so forth. So this is quite liberating for us even now, because each of us here can engage with the teachings at whatever level we want and know that for us, it's entirely appropriate that we then speak or act from what we understand. You know, these eight path factors are not the Ten Commandments. They're not injunctions. There's no should in here. You should be this, you shouldn't be that. It just suggests that if you do this, you might have a greater sense of freedom and liberation. The choice is yours. And as I say, even in the early suttas, you know, people had that choice and the Buddha seemed quite fine about that. You know, people will make their own choice. You try and speak as clearly as you can. You be as receptive as you can. However, you know, people will go their own way. Okay. So as with any path or any map, we need to get a view. And I think this is a really appropriate place to start. I do quite like that the Eightfold Path has a couple of factors at the start that are about getting a view. And we can call it getting an overview or creating a map, because a map not only has boundaries, it has a suggestion of direction as well. And there's some security that comes with that. You may have had times in your life already where you feel that the map isn't working very well, or you lose your path, your direction, and you know how that feels. It's quite disconcerting. It can bring up some anxiety as well. So this map is a sort of a cognitive, an intellectual, if you like, place to stand. I get how it all gets put together, and I can work from there. There's a sense of security with that, and it was most important. And so right view and right intention are the first two factors. Now, just to say here, of course, that a cognitive overview is not enough. You know, it's interesting. And if you're a scholar, of course, you're interested in the cognitive overview, the maps, the, you know, the arcane and interesting and different and complex maps. But they don't lead to liberation. What's missing is the application of those maps to our own lives, to our dynamic, changing lived experience. That's where the rubber hits the road, in our own experience. So the principles are very useful. We need to move beyond just the principles, but we should start there, I think, too. I don't want to labour the Eightfold Path. You can look it up online. There's been, you know, millions of words written about it. I just want to add a few words to it, some very basic things that I hope we can then take away if something resonates and go, oh, that makes sense, that bit I can follow and use in my own life. So the first one is right view. A view is so important, an understanding of the total path if we can. But the total path is complex. There's a lot to it. You know, you've all seen the suttas and the sutras and, you know, all the Tibetan texts as well. I mean, huge libraries have been filled with these texts. So let's come down to the basics. Then from my perspective, there's a couple of sets of basics. And one is simply the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering, you know, unsatisfactoriness, if you want to use that word. It has a cause, thank goodness. Once we understand a cause, we can work towards the cessation or gradual ceasing of the causes. So we have some say, we have choice, thank goodness. And finally, there's a path, which is what we're talking about tonight. And of course, we know the cause of suffering in a Buddhist sense is craving, getting caught up in that and craving for more, craving to get away from. You know, it's this constant movement forward or away from. It's a very primal movement for all sentient beings, really, isn't it? Approach avoidance. So craving is more than that, though. Craving is an involvement in trying to grasp onto and hold. Now, we haven't got time to go through the wheel of dependent origination tonight, but there's a little set of four or five factors there that are very telling about craving and grasping. And the grasping is likened to burning as well, you know, like holding onto a coal that's hot, but we just can't stop doing it. We need to see that it's burning and go, hang on, I don't need to pick that coal up anymore. So that's the Four Noble Truths. Very useful just to contemplate them in our own lives. Is there any suffering in my own life? Is there something in the way I'm viewing the world, viewing myself, that's causing suffering? And can I do something about it through understanding that? And the second to understand is karma. Now, again, this is a whole huge topic in itself. But karma, certainly in early Buddhism, has quite a simple meaning. It just means volitional action. And it's even simpler way of understanding that is using a word I've just used, choice. We have choices. We would like to make wise choices or right choices. So it's understanding that choices have consequences, and those consequences feed back into who we are. They feed back into our social scenario, our context, our lived life. And so we have this feedback loop again. But there are such things as volitional actions. So we don't just have a thought about something. We nurture the thought and then we act on the thought. And then certain things may happen because of that. In a nutshell, that's karma. We don't have to get into the whole debate about whether it goes over, you know, many lifetimes or whether it's happening instantaneously. And, you know, we just need to know there's choice, there's consequences. Now, that's not a difficult concept. You know, 6 and 7 year olds are getting that concept, aren't they? And they're getting it cognitively as well. Oh, if I do that, then this happens, you know. But do we always act in a way that shows that we deeply understand that and we live with that understanding. And I would put out the proposition that sometimes we don't. We do things that will get us something in the short term, knowing that maybe there's going to be some payback at some stage if we're unlucky. Anyway, so we have choice. So right view wants us to examine the way our thoughts and beliefs work, but the way this whole fundamental system works, this body-mind system works. So this is right view. And following hard on the heels and mixed in with right view is right intention. So intention, once again, is about choice. It's about it's the direction we take, the influences we allow to be around us, making choices with whom we associate, what we read, how we speak, and so, you know, body, speech, and mind, as it's often called. Underwriting tension, there's a factor called renunciation, and I mentioned the word renunciation before in relation to the Siddhartha leaving home. So renunciation is one of those words, again, like right or, you know, right action, right speech, that many people don't like. And there are whole cultures that renounce renunciation. They don't realise it, but it's not a nice word for them. Because it sounds like we're getting all narrow and tight and rejecting things and maybe rejecting other people and their views. And we want openness and freedom and not renunciation. So it's really important to understand what's meant by renunciation in Buddhism. What are we renouncing? Ultimately, we're renouncing, if you like, ignorance. Ignorance that causes suffering, not seeing clearly. So if we're walking on a path, we would want to go more deeply into our experience, particularly in term, from a Buddhist perspective, we're practicing renunciation. We may well choose to go into a more traditional lifestyle, be it a nun or a monk. We might choose to do a longer retreat. We might choose to do a shorter retreat. We might choose to do a few minutes a day at home or simply do reading. But these are all aspects of renunciation. So there's a sort of positive spin, if you like, or angle or depth to renunciation. But, you know, it's in some places it's not a popular word. So you may want to find another word to use if you're talking about Buddhist practice with your friends. And more positively, I suppose, under renunciation, under right intention, there's the intention to cultivate wholesome states of mind. And things like metta, karuna, you know, loving kindness and compassion would be in there. Just on those two qualities of mind, qualities of heart, metta and karuna, loving kindness and compassion, it's interesting that in the early suttas, metta is very much associated with spaciousness, openness, opening the mind to all directions, above and below and to all the directions. It's very much about radiating loving kindness, but there is very much a sense of spaciousness, openness. It has something to do with concentration as well, absorption, the mind being still, being focused. So it's a very suggestive word, and it can be interpreted in a number of different ways. Alongside of that, we have karuna. And karuna is interesting because it's about compassion. Compassion is about understanding suffering. How do we understand suffering? Well, cognitively, of course, we can look around and see suffering. We just talked about that a little earlier. But really what motivates us is understanding suffering at whatever level, even the minutest level, from our own perspective. Understanding discomfort, understanding boredom, understanding anger or frustration, all of those things. And if we can understand those things and be with them to a certain extent, without being overwhelmed by them or pushing them away, our heart then can be far more open with this steady mind that's meant to accompany it, be far more open to other people because we ourselves resonate with that. It's more than just an emotion though. You know, that would be more like sympathy. There is a view, there's a cognition, there's a way that the mind is, which is quite open and steady, and we can be overwhelmed by suffering. So this is one also we need to be cautious around too. We need to be quite steady in ourselves as well to move more deeply into understanding suffering. And so if we're going to do that, it's very useful to practice right intention and cultivate loving kindness. Goodwill, benevolence, there's a number of words. If loving kindness is too big, friendliness, that's a great place to start. So we come on to the second level, which is virtue or ethics. Just remember here that, you know, right speech, right action, right livelihood are not nouns, they're verbs. They're doing words, which is what I learned when I was at school. A verb is a doing word. It's active. It's a process. And the whole of Buddhism is about process and relationships in a nutshell. That's it. So these are not static injunctions. It's not the Ten Commandments or the Eight Commandments, as I said before. These are things that are dynamic, changing, and where we do need to investigate how we're living. So remember also, you know, we can talk about the rules, we can talk about various things you should or shouldn't do, and you can read about those really. But it's interesting to me that in the early suttas, certainly, all those rules for monks and nuns, they emerged quite gradually because of the context people were in and because of what happened with the monks particularly and the sorts of rules that needed to come up to help train people's minds, I suppose, and their behaviours. So it didn't start with the Buddha going, right, here's 263 rules that you all need to follow. You know, and there's some interesting ones in there, which makes you wonder what was happening when those rules were formulated. There were very few rules. One example would be, apparently, the rule about only eating up until midday with the Theravada, with the early Sangha, was because people were going around in the afternoon or evening and wanted to get food, and it was difficult for the householders to do that. And so the Buddha said, okay, we don't need to be eating in the evening. We cut off at lunchtime. That way we live in harmony with our community. We can give back to them and they can offer to us as well. And so, again, we have literally a feedback loop, quite literally. But that's an example of a rule, if you like, a way of being that's evolved out of context. Now, our context is not one of monks or nuns in the forest, in a small village, near a small village. We need to reinterpret these things, go to the spirit of them, and think, what does that mean for me? Am I living in harmony with my community? Okay. And fundamentally underneath those three factors, right speech, right action, right livelihood, is what's called ahimsa, non-harm. And if that's the one thing we remember from those three factors, it's a great, great thing to remember. Am I causing harm to myself or others? Now, that sounds lovely, and it is lovely. It's very inspiring. However, let's go where the rubber's hitting the road on this one. And we don't have much time at the moment. We may be a little later to talk about this. But if we're talking about non-harm, what does that mean about meat eating? What does that mean about profiting at someone else's expense, the whole capitalist system? What does it mean about euthanasia? What does it mean about cheating on an exam? And I'm not looking at anybody on that one. But we know that it's rife in universities. So, you know, what does it mean about protesting at the Black Lives Matter? How should we do that? Is that right action? Is it causing harm? So these are quite involved and, you know, more than interesting questions, vital questions to ask. This is where the rubber hits the road. This is where the practice really begins. And this is what spurs us on to deeper practice as well, I think. So let's not forget that the Buddhist practice is very much a social and ethical practice. In my own view at the moment, which has evolved more and more over the years, is if you remove the ethical from the path, it's not a Buddhist practice. So if you're doing mindfulness and there's no ethical content, if there's no relational communal content about how to live, in my mind, it's not Buddhist practice. Now, again, they're my words. And you may well want to view that quite differently. And I encourage you to explore that for yourself as well. Okay. So right effort. This is a very interesting factor, having done a lot of practice in Burma myself, because there was very much an emphasis on striving. And also in Thailand as well. I think that's probably culturally appropriate. I think for a lot of Westerners, especially young males who are very driven, they probably needed a different message, which is just to sit back a little bit, chill out, let the world turn, watch the world turning, don't try and force it to turn. So, you know, right effort, it's probably in a sort of a more Anglo context, more useful to describe that as right energy. And that would be an energy that doesn't spark up and disappear, but it's consistent over time and maybe builds as it goes along. Certainly in Burma, when I was there, on any number of occasions, I would see these intense young men come in and they would be, you know, immaculate in their practice and they'd disappear after 3, 4 or 5 days. It was too much too soon. and it was too tight and too tense. So this is why the path is a balanced path. We need to bring mindfulness to that. We need to see what's causing suffering. And they weren't seeing that at any deeper sort of level. The form was good, but what was underneath it was obviously stressful. Another word for dukkha or suffering is stress. So right effort, two basic things. We want to notice and restrain unwholesome mind states, ones that lead to suffering. And we want to cultivate wholesome mind states and then maintain and stabilize them. So this is the concentration or absorption practice. This what's called in some traditions, calm abiding. Calm abiding. The word calm is very useful here. Just to settle. And then from that settled, steady mind to begin noticing more clearly what's going on. So right mindfulness, second last of the factors. There's been a lot written about that and you've heard a lot about that in your talks and so forth. It's often used to initially be translated as seeing things as they are. We need to be cautious about that phrase. It suggests there's some sort of real world out there where, you know, we can just measure it and we will get it. And I don't think the Buddha's interested in statements like that. Remember when the Buddha talked about, he said to a particular person, I will teach you the world. Now that is a confident statement. Think, oh really, are you really? But then he went on to say, the world is this fathom long body. In other words, the world is your experience of the world. That is all the senses on the outside and the senses on the inside. That's all we can ever know. And that's all the Buddha was ever teaching us to take stock of, that world. So statements, metaphysical statements about reality, whilst they do crop up in Buddhism, certainly, and as Buddhism evolved and changed and grew, that more and more. My reading of early Buddhism is that the Buddha wasn't really interested in those sorts of statements. It's interesting, what's your experience? And if we look at when he met up with certain people who come to see him, he would ask them, what's your experience? And sometimes he would go, well, that's completely wrong. And here's you know, the way I see it. And of course they go, oh, that's amazing. And why didn't I see it that way? And now I do. And maybe come to full enlightenment at the same time. But the world that he's talking about is our world. So once again, this is an individualized practice. So we need to come to our own experience and contemplate that, whether it's in meditation or in cognition or socially as well again. And the way we need to view this world is, look, we're checking out the teachings. Is it impermanent? Is it subject to change? When I ignore that and try and treat this body, mind, my sense of self as permanent, is there suffering? Does it work? Is it a good strategy? And of course, the Buddha would want to say, no, it's not a good strategy because it's impossible. This world, your experience, your own body, mind doesn't work that way. So we're in some sort of way, we're according with nature, with the way things are, hence that phrase. But we can't just take that on board as a statement. We need to investigate for ourselves. And finally, right concentration or meditation is usually talked about in terms of jhanas, absorption, the various refined levels of mind. But can open us more to this spacious mind and a refined sense of self, if there's any sense of self left. But also under right concentration is cultivation of some of the qualities we've talked about, non-attachment, calmness, kindness, compassion, clarity of mind, awareness, and insight into the nature of our own experience, mind and body. That's also part of right concentration, right meditation. So we're on the downhill run now, but we'll take the downhill run very mindfully. We don't want to stumble at the end here and tumble down the hill. So just some final thoughts on meditation and this Eightfold Path. I've said that it's active and dynamic. And what that really means is about your lives as you live them and as they're changing and as circumstances come at you. But because it's active and dynamic, there is that question that's right at the very start of what we began to talk about. How do we know what's right and wrong? You know, how do we answer some of these questions? So I want to read a tiny bit of the Kalama Sutta to you, and most of you will know that anyway. And the Buddha says to the Kalamas, who are a bit confused by all these spiritual teachers who claim to have the truth, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement, through pondering views, by probability, or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. When you know for yourselves that these qualities are skillful, now I've talked a bit about what would be identified as skillful qualities, those leading away from harmfulness, from suffering. These qualities are blameless. These qualities are praised by the wise. These qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness. Then you should enter and remain in them. It's a very simple teaching. In the early days of that being translated for Westerners, bits of that were dropped out. So listening to the wise often didn't feature. It was just, you've got to figure it out for yourself. And of course, that could lead to simply getting caught up in a sort of narcissism, I suppose. I say this and I think it's wise, therefore, you know, it's right. And here we need to remember that that Buddhism has always been a communal activity. And so we check in with the wise. And in our case, the wise may well be books as well. We mightn't have access to a teacher immediately. We mightn't have one on tap like the Buddha. But we can go to books, to teachers, to videos, to YouTube clips, all of these things that we consider to be wise. And it's very helpful for us to help us keep standing and keep walking forward. On the other hand, we don't want to get caught up with just peer pressure and community. So whilst we're checking in with our friends about our behaviours and so forth, and we're moderating ourselves in relation to our friends, we don't want to become tribal either, which seems to be what happens in times of stress. We tend to retreat into tribes of people who think and feel like us and gain security by then rejecting others. It makes us feel more boundaried, stronger, a bit tighter. The Buddha didn't recommend that either. But he didn't discount being advised by our community, but ultimately we have to live it for ourselves and check out if it works. And maybe our communities will change as we grow. But it is an experiential path as well. So it is dynamic and we need all those factors to help keep us on track. So when you know for yourself is not narcissistic, there's something in there about just reflecting on our own experience. And when it's approved by the wise, isn't just about community, or it's about a wholesome community and not just peer pressure or tribalism. Now, for myself, I found a couple of simple questions that help me contemplate these sorts of things. One is what I'm doing, is what I'm thinking, is the way I'm behaving leading towards or away from suffering? Is it just for my benefit? Now, you know, I'm a counsellor, most of you will know that. And when I'm speaking with people, I hope I listen a fair bit too, unlike tonight where I'm talking a lot. I have to ask myself from time to time, before I say something, and it's almost like tuning into a bodily sense as well, is this just for me? Am I wanting to sound smart or wise or whatever it happens to be? Am I getting too forceful and so forth, just making them think like I think? So is it leading towards or away from suffering, both mine and people around me as well? And this is a really useful one, the second one, I think. Is it for my and others' long-term benefit, not short-term? That doesn't deny that we want to also aim for short-term benefit, but actually it's about what carries forward in life. Is it for our long-term benefit? Is it for the long-term benefit of those around us? And again, that doesn't mean just having everybody think the way that we do because we know that we're right. We need to take a leaf out of the Buddha's teaching book here and go, well, people will make up their own minds. We can disagree, and we can even disagree very strongly. But if we were to go further and get into a fight, an argument, does anybody benefit from that? Have we really ever changed anybody's opinion by having a stand-up argument? We just get more tense and tight around our own views, and we get caught up in what the Buddha called a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a tangle of views. So clearly not a good thing. And we sort of harden to this. The sense of self becomes quite hard and tight at that point. We can feel it ourselves. We're often very angry at that point too. So once again, we want to cultivate what's called kusala, wholesome actions, and not akusala, unwholesome. And we've talked a bit about what that means. So finally, just to really wrap up, is to say that this reflection on the path, on the Eightfold Path, goes hand in hand with reflection on our own life, what's happening on the inside, thoughts, feelings, the heart quality, and contemplating how that is manifesting in our social environment as well. What we're doing with our friends, to our friends, what we're doing to ourselves. We're growing, and how do we want to grow? We can cultivate ourselves, as it were, but we're never out of relationship, either with ourselves or with other people. We're always in relationship. So if there's one thing we take away from the talk tonight about the Eightfold Path, is am I cultivating wholesome relationships with myself and with others? And just finally, a verse from the Dhammapada, which simplifies it beautifully, simple and very deep. It's the hardest thing to say. And that is not to do any evil, to cultivate what is wholesome, to purify the mind. This is the teaching of the Buddhas. Okay, thank you. And I'm happy to keep talking for a while if people want to ask questions or add. I'd be very happy to do that for a while. So thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael, for the very insightful talk. Does anyone has any question?
Or just comments?
Yes, comments is welcome as well. If you have any question, you can unmute yourself.
I thought the perspective on Ahisa on the capitalist system,
yes,
was interesting. Because then, like, how do you navigate and become like do non-harmfulness within a capitalist system, or does it only exist without a capitalist system?
That's a question I can't answer. A few minutes we've got. I'll let myself off the hook a little bit. But probably worth remembering, again, my reading of early Buddhism certainly, is that at one level the world is perfect, meaning it is the way it is, whatever the context is in each time and place and so forth. So there's a certain sort of reality factor. I don't think the Buddha in the early suttas was focused on the world changing to a way where everybody treated each other in a wholesome way. I think he was prepared to teach, and it may well have gone out from there. And certainly he seemed to be interested in speaking, allowing himself to speak to as many people as possible. And we can do that. But the idea that there's going to be a perfect world or a perfect system. System inherently is somewhat rigid. So the world keeps turning, our needs keep changing, populations keep growing. It's going to be dynamic. But within any system, there are still choices we can make. So in more traditional religions, for example, they might tithe, it's a very old-fashioned word, tithe a proportion of their income, maybe 10% or something, to that religious institution. Now, we mightn't do that. But although we need to remember that dana was absolutely the heart of Buddhist practice and has kept it going as well for all these years, you know, selfless offerings. But we might consider dana to be donating something, time or money, support in some sort of way to a particular worthy cause as we see that, whatever you think that is. And that would be a way of saying, okay, this is the world I live in, but here's something I can do at my level. And we don't want to get caught up with, as I said right at the start, helplessness and despair and what's the point? I can't do anything. So I may as well just go and, you know, drink a lot and make as much money as I can and, you know, get out of here as quickly as possible, having amassed the most money. It's an option and you might decide to do that. But my point is we have choice. And remember, choice is another way of talking about karma, intentional action. So we have choices. This practice should empower you, but it does ask difficult questions once we really start thinking about it. What does it mean to be ethical? And we find out straight away it's not that easy. It's not a simple set of things to do. So I have to bat that one back to you there. And to everybody who's listening too.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you for the talk. It was really inspiring. And thanks for doing it on Zoom as well in this really interesting times. I did have a comment on like one of the things you sort of concluded with around the around what you said about the things that we should keep in mind, like whether our actions, like thoughts and behaviors bring suffering to ourselves and like others and the long-term benefit. I feel like it's really simple, but it's very straight to the point. So thank you for sharing that.
Yes. Well, I also got it from somebody else, and Tanjeff Tanisaro, who's a very well-known teacher now residing in the States. I read something by him and it really struck me. Thank you, Katie. Yeah. Because I thought, gee, that's so simple. And it's hard to distill wisdom into a simple statement that has depth as well, you know, retains that depth. And it gives us some guidelines as well. And it is good to maybe reflect each night on, you know, what we've done during the day and whether it accords with that. In fact, I know I've told you this story before, but I'll say it again because it's one of those simple teachings I find quite useful. It's the story of the Zen master. And, you know, there's a million stories of Zen masters, aren't there? This is a beautiful one of the Zen master Huichi, and quite a modern Zen master, I think, too, not one lost in the mist of time. He'd go to bed at night, he'd drink his tea, he'd finish it, and he'd turn his teacup upside down and put it on the bed on the table next to the bed. Say, well, that's the day finished. My actions are complete, whatever I've done. And then when he woke up in the morning, he would turn the cup over and it's ready to be filled. So it's a metaphor for how we choose to go through that day. And, you know, I've actually, one of my clients, for example, I told her that story because she was interested in Buddhism, had some practice and so forth. And she loved that story and she started doing that and found it very, very helpful. So it wasn't just a story for her. It was a reminder. You know, as we talk about the bell of mindfulness and all sorts of things, but for her, that was an actual practice. My day, in a sense, is empty. Things will come to me. Things will fill up that cup, but I have some choice over what goes in there as well. And at the end of the day, it's done. And really that, then the idea of doing what's for long-term benefit, it's made up of these very short-term day-by-day actions. You know, so we have an idea of what's for the long-term benefit of all beings, but actually it comes back to our, you know, daily actions. There's a woman called Annie Dillon, I think, who said, how we spend our days is how we spend our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very nice.
That is very nice. Thank you for sharing.
Mm-hmm.